So we're here on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, five lines up from the bottom. And let's just review what we know so far. The issue here is that if there's a conflict between the Avoda and Mikra Megillah. The Avoda, which is incumbent upon the Kohanim, of course the Levim have to come and sing while the Korban is brought, and the Yisraelim have to come and stand in the Azar at the time of the bringing of the Korban. All of these have to start their Avoda with the crack of dawn, with daybreak. But at that same moment, the assembly, the congregation, is getting together for the reading, for the public reading of the Megillah. So the Gemara establishes, as we saw last time, that in such a case, in such a conflict, Mikra Megillah wins out. Megillah takes precedent. And again, just to shorten, we'll talk about the Kohanim. The Kohanim, instead of starting their Avoda with Heir Hayom, with the break of dawn, they will postpone their Avoda, that's the way Tosfos explains it, in order to hear the Megillah at that point. Again, if the Megillah could be read at a different point, that's a different story. But we're talking about a case where there's a head-on collision between these two mitzvos, the mitzvah of Avoda on the one hand, and the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah on the other hand. And the Gemara quotes Rabbi Yossi, and the Gemara quotes Rabbi Yudah Merav, and the Gemara quotes a Brisa to this effect. All the above agree that mevatlim kohanim me'avodasam lishma mikra megillah, that the kohen, instead of doing his avoda, will put the avoda on hold, he'll postpone it, and he'll go to attend the public reading of the Megillah. And this halacha is derived from a verse in the Megillah itself, Mishpacha u'Mishpacha, which is referring in this case to Mishpachas Kohuna and Mishpachas Leviyah, that they too will come to hear the Megillah, even though it means that they will have to postpone their avoda, their service in the Migdash. That's what we know until this point. Now we're going a little bit further. Mikan, based on this halacha, Samchu shall base Rebbe, Rabbi Yudah Nasi, and his Talmidim and his students, that was called the base Rebbe, the whole yeshiva there, they relied on this halacha to derive their own conclusion. And we'll see in a minute how they derive this conclusion. What is the conclusion that they derived? Just like if you have a conflict between Megillah reading and Avoda, Megillah reading wins out, then how much more so if you have a conflict between Megillah reading and Talmud Torah, the mitzvah of Torah study, Megillah reading wins out, and Torah study will be put on the back burners, as it were. We postpone it. We push it off. So let's read it inside. Mikan, based on this halacha, Samchu shall base Rebbe, those students of Rebbe relied, Samchu means they relied on the above mentioned principle, and they derived the following conclusion, Shemevatlim Talmud Torah Uboin Lishma Mikra Megillah. Basically, they're reformulating the halacha that we know, except they're substituting, instead of saying Mevatlin Avodasam Uboin Lishma Mikra Megillah, they are saying Mevatlin Talmud Torah Uboin Lishma Mikra Megillah. Now, how do you know that the halacha that we learned above, Mevatlin Avoda, applies to Talmud Torah as well? Maybe one could argue logically that the Kohanim should postpone their Avoda, but someone who's involved in Torah study, that's a great mitzvah, he should not postpone the mitzvah. And maybe Talmud Torah should take precedence over Mikra Megillah. So the Gemara says that Beis Rebbe derived this from a Kal V'Chomer. A Kal V'Chomer means if it applies in this case, which is called Kal, which is called relatively lenient, then how much more so should apply in the case of a case of Chomer. Now, in comparing Avoda and Talmud Torah, we have to decide how to weigh these two mitzvahs. Which is heavier? Which is chamur? And which, on the other hand, is kal, is lighter? It's interesting that the word kal means either lenient or light, lightweighted. And they have the same, more or less the same connotation. So Rebbe operates with the following premise, that Avoda is chamur and Talmud Torah is kal, as we'll soon see. Now this baffles the mind. Let's put this question out there. Why does Rebbe assume that Avoda, the service in the Beis HaMikdash, is chamur, is more severe, more weighty, takes greater precedence than Talmud Torah, and Talmud Torah is kal? After all, Chazal tell us that Talmud Torah is shakul keneged kulam. If you put all the 612 mitzvahs on one side of the balance and put Talmud Torah on the other side, Talmud Torah would at least equal all the sum total of the other 612. Not only that, but the Gemara says that Talmud Torah is the way, is the method by which we can understand God's wisdom and we come to Dveikus. Avoda, on the other hand, seems to be a mitzvah, a significant mitzvah, but a mitzvah nonetheless. And yet, as I indicated before, Rebbe's premise here is that Avoda is greater than Talmud Torah. And he doesn't bother telling us why or how he derived this conclusion. And look at the next line in the Gemara. He spells it out. He says, Uma Avoda. Every Kama Chomer starts with the word Uma and ends up with the word Lo Kolshken. Uma, how do you look at the case of Avoda? Which is Shehi Chamura. It's very severe. It's very significant. And it's more important. It outweighs, it outdistances Talmud Torah. Mevatlinon. And yet, for the sake of Mikra Megillah, we will be Mevatel, we'll put off the Avoda, and we'll come to hear the Megillah reading, Talmud Lomar, which is relatively kal, it's lenient, lo kolshkein, isn't it more so? How much more so is that the case? And so, the premise here is that in a race, in a competition between Avoda and Talmud Torah, Avoda would outdistance Talmud Torah, and yet Mikra Megillah outdistances Avoda. So you imagine if you had a race and three contestants were lined up at the starting line. One is Mikra Megillah, two is Avoda, the Kohen's Avoda, and three is Talmud Torah. Now they shoot off the gun and the race starts. Who's going to win in this race? Who's going to come in first? Mikra Megillah. Who's going to come in second? Avoda. And who's going to come in number third? Talmud Torah. Because Mikra Megillah wins out against Avoda, and Avoda wins out against Talmud Torah. And therefore, for sure, Mikra Megillah, which outdistance Avoda, would certainly outdistance Talmud Torah. And now, the rest of the sugya, the rest of this Gemara, from this point and on, is going to challenge this premise of Rebbe and Beis Rebbe. Namely, the Gemara is going to try to prove that on the contrary, as we say in Yiddish, punkfaker, just the opposite, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is greater, it's more significant than the mitzvah of Avoda. Now, by the way, there's a very long discussion here. We're not going to go through it now. The Gemara is talking about an either-or situation. Either you learn Torah, or you got to hear the Megillah. And it's one or the other. And in this case, the Gemara tips the scale in favor of the Megillah. At least that's what Beis Rebbe assumed. But we can think about this and ask ourselves the following question. Is this really a collision? Is the choice decision between Talmud Torah and Mikra Megillah mutually exclusive? It's one or the other, either A or B.
At one particular time,
is it? What if I were to tell you that Mikra Megillah is itself Talmud Torah? Now, what do I mean by that? Megillah is one of the 24 holy books of the Tanakh. And when a person learns and studies the Megillah, or even hears the Megillah, just simple reading of the Megillah, he fulfills the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. I'll give you an example. Let's say I woke up in the morning and I haven't yet recited Birchas HaTorah, and I'm not allowed to study Torah without reciting the bracha, the blessing. Would I be allowed to read the Megillah before I recited the bracha on Talmud Torah? Whether it's Lasok B'Divrei Torah, the way the Ashkenazim have it, or Al Divrei Torah, the way the Sephardim have it. Everybody would agree, no one would deny, that Megillah itself is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. There are many different ways of fulfilling the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Even within Torah Shebech Sav, there are 24 different books. But then you have Torah Shebaal Peh, and we've spoken about it. That's a wide array of areas, of disciplines of study. But one thing that's equal to all of them, whether it's Torah Shebech Sav, the 24 books, whether it's Torah Shebaal Peh, they all come under the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And they all would require a blessing. Let's call it Lasok B'Divrei Torah. And therefore Megillah, insofar as Megillah is part of the Torah, why does the Gemara see this as a head-on collision? Why can't I have both? My cake and eat it. I can have the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah, and at the same time, by hearing the Megillah, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of Talmud Torah.
But if you want to study some other part of Torah at that particular time, and not Megillah, then there's a conflict.
Right, but the Gemara is not analyzing that. The Gemara is not asking which part of Torah you're going to learn. The Gemara is asking which mitzvah comes first. Is it A or B? It's like it reminds me of the Gemara in Shabbos. If you have one candle, and it's Erev Shabbos, and it's also Chanukah, so what do you do with that candle? Do you use it for Chanukah, or do you use it for Shabbos? The premise of the Gemara is that one candle cannot serve both. It's an either-or situation. They're mutually exclusive. Here too, the Gemara's underlying assumption is which mitzvah is greater, and now the Gemara's going to embark on a whole long discussion and analysis, which mitzvah is greater? The mitzvah of Havodah, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Forget about which mitzvah is greater, just hear the Megillah. Again, within the context of my obligation to learn Torah, read Torah, I'm not confined to anything in particular. In fact, if you told me that Reuven, a particular individual, studies Megillas Esther over and over again for the rest of his life, I would tell you he gets a prize for that. He's continuously involved in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. If Shimon, for example, reads Tehillim, that's his favorite book, and he likes to read Tehillim over and over and over again, he too has a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And that's the nature of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Whenever you read any verses in Torah Shebech Sav, in the written Torah, which includes Megillah as well, you fulfill the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. So why embark on this whole long analysis of which mitzvah is greater and which pushes off the is? You know, if I have the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah, and that points to a particular section of the Torah that I should be studying now at this point, together with the entire tzibur, the whole community of Israel, so I'm not forfeiting my mitzvah of Talmud Torah, I'm not undermining it. In fact, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Again, this is a long, long discussion about this. I'm not going to belabor you now with this because I want to get on to the crux of the sugya. But I will tell you something interesting that I found in the name of Reb Chaim of Brisk. That's my Rebbe's grandfather. And he's quoted as saying that the concept of Mevatlim Talmud Torah, of giving up and forfeiting the mitzvah Talmud Torah, applies even in a case of someone who's going to drop the Torah in order to study Torah in the following sense, in the following scenario. He says, Im osek batorah, ela sheyachol lilmod biyeser iun v'amoka. If he's learning Torah, but he has the possibility of studying Torah with greater depth and with greater analysis, and instead he opts, v'ulomed bi'ofen shitchi. Does anybody know what the word shitchi means? Superficial. He studies Torah on a superficial level. Gam zen nichlal bichlal bitul Torah. Wow, this is fascinating. Within the context of one mitzvah, we can set up a qualitative difference between one type of study, one type of fulfillment to this mitzvah, and another type of study, another type of fulfillment to the mitzvah. So presumably what Reb Chaim means to say is that if he drops his profound involvement on the deeper levels of analyzing Torah for the sake of hearing the Megillah, which means he will study the Megillah on a very superficial level, if he gets too involved in the Megillah while they're reading it, he probably won't be able to hear it. I know people who get distracted during the Megillah reading. That's not good. So you have to really listen and clue in to every single word of the Megillah. Now's not the time to be Mechadish Chidushin, to start coming up with insights. You know, you'll lose it. You'll miss the Megillah reading. So Rav Chaim assumes that Megillah reading is a superficial type of Talmud Torah. Not that we're denying that it's Talmud Torah. If he were to drop his in-depth study for the sake of hearing the Megillah, he would still be fulfilling the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. But insofar as he has it, he has the capability, the possibility of learning Torah in depth, and he gives that up for a superficial reading of the Torah, he has forfeited the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. That's a fantastic chidush of Reb Chaim. I would never have said such a thing. I would never have taken a mitzvah and breaking it and smash it into two different parts and say that qualitatively one fulfillment of the mitzvah is that much greater than the other. And that we're not measuring it in quantitative terms. He's saying qualitatively it's different to the extent in which we see this situation that he finds himself in as a head-on collision in which he has to choose between one mitzvah and the other. In this case, between one mitzvah of Talmud Torah and another mitzvah of Talmud Torah. One mitzvah of Talmud Torah, which is qualitatively different than the other, is what he calls limud be'iyun ubaha'amaka, with great analysis and depth. That is a qualitatively different, unique mitzvah of Talmud Torah relative to studying Torah by reading psukim in Tanakh. It's very nice to read verses in Tanakh, and no doubt you would have to make birchas haTorah on that. It's part of the mitzvah Talmud Torah, but relative to what you're capable of, if you're a wise person and you have, you know, God has bestowed upon you great capabilities, and you've studied in the past, and you have the ability to take it even further, to give that up for the sake of reading psukim in Tanakh would be bittul Torah.
Think of
Right. That's why I think Reb Chaim
analysis makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Reb Chaim wants to probably balance. You know, you can't jump to analysis and in-depth study without some breadth of knowledge, even on a superficial level. In other words, if you're not somewhat oriented, you know, in different sugyas, you know, you're going to say chidushim, you're going to give your insights, and somebody's going to laugh at you. He's going to say it contradicts this and it's against that, you know. But within the balance of it, if you've gotten to the point, as Beis Revi and his yeshiva did, where they were capable of really, you know, expanding the frontiers of knowledge in Torah and coming up with new insights, and by the way, I think that would apply even in our day. Even in the year Tavshin Ayin Aleph, you know, we could still have scholars who are coming up with new insights, and certainly, you know, applying the halacha in a new, in a very unique and novel way, as it never has been applied before. I mean, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to hear a shiur from Rabbi Akiva, he didn't even understand it was so advanced. You know, imagine that. So there are insights and there are depths. If you're ready for that, and you're capable of that, then instead you waste away your time by rereading things that you've seen since you're 0 years old, Reb Chaim says that's Bittul Torah. Even though at the moment that you're reading whatever you're reading, it is a fulfillment of the mitzvah Talmud Torah, you'd have to make a brach on that, but relative to what you're capable of doing at that particular time, you have really forfeited the mitzvah Talmud Torah. It's a paradoxical situation. On the one hand, we're going to classify you as mevatel Talmud Torah, you're giving up Talmud Torah. On the other hand, you're mekayem Talmud Torah. But Reb Chaim doesn't see that as a conflict, because he understands there are two different modes or dimensions of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. All right, let's go on, because really time is moving and I want to get to the major part of the sugya. The Gemara says the following. The Gemara now challenges the assumption, the premise of Rebbe, that avoda is greater than Talmud Torah. The avoda chamura mi Talmud Torah? This is a rhetorical question. Is it really so that avoda is weightier, it's more significant than Talmud Torah? Vaksiv, now the Gemara is going to quote part of a pasuk, and part of a parasha, I should say. This parasha appears in Sefer Yoshua. You remember, of course, that Yoshua entered into the land in order to conquer it. And when he came to Jericho, the Jewish soldiers put a siege around the city of Jericho, and this lasted for some period of time. And there was an episode, an encounter during this period of time that took place between Yoshua and a certain figure. I call him a figure because it was difficult, especially at night, as the Gemara says, to discern, to identify who he was. And the Tanakh tells us many, many details about this encounter between Yoshua and the, we'll call him the unknown figure. So what does it say over there? Vayehi biyos Yoshua biyericho. As Yoshua was in Jericho, on the verge of attacking Jericho, vayisa einov, he lifts up his eyes, vayar, and he beholds, vihine ish omed lenegdo. There's a certain person who's standing, it doesn't say exactly how many feet away, but apparently at pretty close proximity, lenegdo. The Gemara stops here. I'll read to you some of the other psukim that come in the middle, just that you have a background to this whole episode, some of the details. V'charbo shlufa biyado. This man was holding a sword in his hand. That's significant. Vayelech Yoshua elav. Yoshua approaches him. Vayomer lo. And he turns to him with a question. Halonu ata im litzareinu. Which literally means, are you backing us up? Are you with us? Or litzareinu, or do you belong to the other team, to the bad guys, to those who are enemies of ours? Vayomer, and he responds, lo, you're misunderstanding, you don't follow my identity, you're not understanding me. Ki ani, he identifies himself, tzva, sar tzva Hashem. I am the officer in the host of God. And the word Hashem implies mentioning the name of God. I'm just not saying it, but he said it. Ata Bosi. Ata with an ayin. I came now. When Yoshua hears this, Vayipol Yoshua al panav arza, and then you'll see the next word in your Gemara, Vayishtachu. Yoshua prostrates himself on the floor, on the ground in front of this person. And again, I'm going to read to you one more pasuk that's left out of the Gemara. Vayomer lo, and Yoshua turns to this individual, this figure, this gone figure who's holding on to the cherev, and he says to him, Ma Adoni medaber el avdo. What, my master, do you have to tell my servant? Your servant, excuse me. Meaning, Yoshua understood that this Sar Tzva Hashem, this angelic figure, was coming to say something. And Yoshua said, all right, tell me what you have to say. Apparently you're sent on a message, you know, with a message. Tell me what you have to say. Okay, we have a little bit of the background, and we didn't really scratch the surface yet, but we began. Now, the Gemara takes a digression. We're not yet ready to analyze the issue at hand, namely, what's greater, Avoda or Talmud Torah. But put that on the side for just 1 minute, because the Gemara wants to understand how Yoshua actually spoke to this fellow. V'hechi Ovid Hachi. How did Yoshua, why was he permitted to engage this figure in conversation and assume, you know, he bows down to him, he calls him Adoni, he says, I am your servant. All this kavod, all this honor that he bestows upon this figure who's unidentified, who calls himself a Sar Tzva Hashem. Could you imagine, my friends, if one day you're walking down the street and you see some strange looking guy and you ask him, who are you? Are you with us or against us? And he says, well, I'm the Sar Tzva Hashem. I'm the head of the divine military force. I mean, you'd probably put him in a loony bin, right? So the Gemara says, Hechi Avid Hachi. Why did Yoshua take this guy seriously? V'Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Isn't it true that we have a statement made by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? We've heard that name a lot lately. Asur li Adam, sheyitein shalom lechavero balayla. A person should not give shalom, shalom by the way is the name of God, to his friend at night. Why not? Chayshinon, we're afraid, Shema Shadehu. Maybe he's a shade. Maybe he's not really who you think he is. Now, a shade, I don't know, how would you translate the word shade? A demon, I don't know, we'll call it a demon for lack of a better word. These demons, according to the Gemara, were mazikim, they were negative forces that brought havoc, they brought destruction. And one is not permitted to say the name of God, in this case Shalom, near, in close proximity to these shadim, to any one of these shadim. And how much more so would it be prohibited to bow down to a shade?
Thinking that in the daytime you could tell the difference and at night you
couldn't. Right, correct. In the daytime, the shadim were not able to disguise themselves as human beings and fool other human beings. They could disguise themselves, but it would be very... At nighttime, when vision is blurry, that's when the shadim had the ability to appear as human beings when they were really shadim. And here in the case of Yoshua, when he met the Tsar Tzava, it was at night. And the reason why I believe, this is just my thesis, that this whole story happened at night, the Tanakh doesn't exactly tell us that it happened at night, it would seem to be because Yoshua himself did not recognize this individual. The proof is, he said, Halonu Atayim L'Sarenu. I don't know who you are. Now, if it was during the day, then it might be a fair premise to assume that Yoshua would probably know whether he's, you know, he's a Jew or he's not a Jew. He's from them or from us. Furthermore, it's probably fair to assume that it was nighttime because they don't do battle during the nighttime. So at nighttime they were encamped. And that's when, logically, this encounter would have taken place. Keep also in mind that Yoshua was in the fields, he was in the mountains, and even during the day it could be his vision was blurred. You know, they were up in higher altitudes and lower altitudes. So the Gemara never says that the meeting between Yoshua and this figure took place at night. The Gemara just equates it to the case of Yoshua, who says that you shouldn't present yourself with a shalom aleichem to someone that you don't recognize. Usually that's at night, but it could be even by day. But again, I don't want to get too much caught up with that because I'm always worried about accomplishing what we have on our agenda for today. The assumption of the Gemara, the premise is that Yoshua could not recognize this individual, and as such, it should have been prohibited to give this person shalom, because this person might not be a person at all, might be a shade that's disguised as a person. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about this concept of a shade, but first let's read just a little bit more in the Gemara. The Gemara says, in this digression here, that Yoshua knew, he was able to tell that this individual was not a shade. How? Shiny Hossam. The case of Yoshua is different. Why? The Amarle, because this angel said to Yoshua, Ki ani sar tzva Hashem, and he mentions the name of God in identifying himself. And that's how Yoshua could know that he wasn't a shade.
We know that a shade wouldn't do that.
Oh, excellent. So first thing about the things that it means, well, look, he himself told Yoshua that he's a sar tzva Hashem. So we know he's not a shade. So the Gemara says, V'dilma mishakre, maybe he's lying. You know, a shade also knows how to lie, right? So the Gemara says, Gmiri, this is to answer your question, we know, you know, we have some sort of tradition, de lomafki shem shamayim levatola, that a shade, lomafki, will not take out, meaning will not enunciate, shem shamayim, the name of God, in vain. So, if he was a shade, then he was saying, well, I am a Sar Tzava Hashem, maybe that's a lie, and maybe he would lie, but he wouldn't lie and mention the name of God. In other words, there was a limit to how bad and how evil the demons were, and there was a boundary line where even the shade would not cross that boundary line. And that is that he would not enunciate the name of God in vain. Because keep in mind, it's very important to realize that Shadim are also messengers of God. In other words, all their powers and all their purposes on this world, when they bring about evil, is divinely ordained. You know, we're not happy to see the Shadim, and we're certainly not overjoyed when they do what they have to do, and we see their impact in this world, but nevertheless, this is part of the divine scheme of retribution and reward and punishment. So there is a limit to how far even a shade would go, and the Gemara postulates that a shade would not mention the name of God in vain. And therefore, insofar as this figure, who Yeshua could not recognize, mentioned the name of God when he identified himself as the Sar Tzva Hashem, therefore Yeshua knew he wasn't the shade. I want to say a few words about Shadim. You know, there's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of decades about the fact that Chazal, especially in the Talmud Bavli, believed in the power of Shadim, of demons. By the way, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Rishonim already point this out. I think Rav Haigon, if I'm not mistaken, points out that at the time that in the Bavli you'll find Shadim, in the Yerushalmi, Rav Haigon says that you won't find Shadim. He believes that somehow the Yerushalmi, which was written in Eretz Yisrael, in that culture in Eretz Yisrael, they didn't have any issues. There was no real discussion about Shadim. But in Bavel, at that time, there was Shadim. Now, ask yourself the question, are there Shadim today? So I just want to tell you, about 100 years ago, there was a genius. His last name was Rosen, but nobody knows that, because they know him as the Rugachover. He came from a city called Rugachov in Lita, in Lithuania. And he already said that at the time of the Rambam, there were no Shadim in the world. In other words, Shadim, according to the Rugachev, existed in the past, but they ceased to exist at some point in history. He identifies that point as the time of the Rambam. Now, let me explain to you why I believe the Rugachev identifies the point in time in which Shadim ceased to exist as the time of the Rambam. The Rambam is very skeptical about Shadim. What do I mean? Every time the Gemara brings down Shadim, the Rambam omits it in his Mishneh Torah. For example, there's a case of Mishneh Gittin about someone who hears a voice from the bottom of a pit, and the voice says, please write a bill of divorce for my wife, and deliver it to her. So the Gemara says, we can't do so until we see him, because maybe he's a Shade. So the Rambam quotes this halacha, but he leaves out that point, maybe he's a Shade. In other words, what the Rambam seems to give you the impression, we just simply don't identify him. He's at the bottom of this pit, and therefore that's not sufficient to write a bill of divorce and deliver that get to his wife. That's a Rambam in Hilchas Gerushin in the second parak. There's also a Rambam in Hilchas Rotzeach, which, by the way, it's not only called Hilchas Rotzeach, the laws of murder, it's also called the laws of Shmiras HaNefesh, because the Rambam there talks about how to protect yourself from potential danger, and one of the laws that's brought down in the Gemara that you shouldn't leave food exposed under the bed, under your bed where you sleep. And the Gemara explains that because of Shadim, that Shadim somehow, especially at night under the bed, that's where they hover around and they do their bad things. So the Rambam quotes this halacha in Hilchos Shmiras HaNefesh in the 12th parak, but he leaves out the whole discussion about Shadim. In other words, the Gemara believes that Shadim are intelligent, living, functioning beings that work in this world. Maybe the Rambam saw them as, I don't know, subhuman kind of animals or something. I don't know what he saw them as. And the Rambam has some sort of a discussion in his Mor Nevuchim, in his Guide to the Perplexed, in the first chelik in the seventh chapter, about who these Shadim were or were not, and so forth and so on. But in any event, according to the Rugachev, the Rambam couldn't have seen any Shadim. He didn't believe in Shadim, the Rambam, and therefore there were no Shadim. They didn't exist. There is one pasuk in Chumash. I don't know if anyone has the possibility of opening up a Chumash for me to the book of Devarim, in the 32nd chapter, I think it's Parshas Hazinu, and there is one pasuk, one verse in the Torah that does seem to postulate the existence of Shadim. However, again, the Rambam is going to come to our rescue and reinterpret that pasuk. Thank you. The pasuk says, let's see if we can read it. This is in Devarim Lamed Beis. It's Parshas Hazinu, and it is pasuk Yud Zayin. And there the Torah says the following. Hazinu is a very difficult parsha. It says Yizbechu LaShedim. I'll keep one finger on the Hebrew, one on the English. They will slaughter, meaning slaughter sacrifices to the demons. Lo Eloha Elohim, gods whom they knew not. Now, is the Torah saying A or B? Is it saying that they, these idol worshippers, will slaughter animal, will slaughter sacrifices for these demons, but these demons really do not exist? Or is the Torah saying that these demons exist, but they have no power? Lo Eloha, they have no power. They are not gods. Anyway, the word Shadim does appear in the Torah.
Doesn't matter.
What?
Doesn't matter in that context.
No, it doesn't matter in that context. Either way would go, but it matters for us because if there's a Torah, if there's a scriptural source for Shadim, again, the word Shadim does appear in the Torah, and if the Torah is saying that the, you know, the Shadim exist and the idol worshippers bring sacrifice to the Shadim, and that's ridiculous because they're not really gods, then the Torah is recognizing the existence of Shadim. I mean, for me personally, you know, that has great meaning. Not because I expect to see a Shade tomorrow, but because I do want to know, did the Torah itself actually believe in Shadim? You know, if the Gemara speaks about Shadim, then you could always say that they existed, or maybe they didn't exist. I'll give you an example of what I have in mind. You know, there's something called a germ, correct? Or you could talk about a virus. Now, do you and I see viruses? Well, you could see them under a microscope. But hundreds of years ago, they didn't have the capability of seeing germs under a microscope. And yet they believed in germs. Not always, but I mean within, let's say, a few centuries ago. I forgot which scientist invented the germ. I mean, I used to know this, but anyway.
Invented the germ.
No, I mean to say who found, you know, discovered. I forgot his name. He's a very well-known scientist, but he lived before they had the microscopes, the capability to see. But he saw the impacts of germs, of viruses. And that's why he postulated that they exist in this world. The Chazal saw the impact of these Shadim, these forces of evil. I mean, for example, the Torah is full of things like sorcery and all sorts of powers of Kishuv. You know, if you ask me, do I believe that these powers exist today? My answer is no. But do I believe that they once existed? I'm not sure about it, but I'm inclined to believe that it did exist. That's my inclination. In any event, my just to summarize my point is that even if Chazal were not able to prove the existence of Shadim, they believed in Shadim because they saw the power and the effect, the impact of Shadim. Just like I believe that viruses exist, even if I don't have the the microscopes to see it in, even before that time, I mean, because I see the impact of those viruses and those germs. Obviously, this requires a great deal of discussion. I mean, I don't know if the rabbi has ever given a lecture here on Shadim, or, you know, it's a very fascinating topic. But this pasuk in Parshas Hazinu really lends itself to two interpretations, depending upon whether you believe that the Torah actually assumed that Shadim existed. Again, never, heaven forbid, do we condone worship of Shadim. The Shadim have no independent power. What they are doing is they're actualizing the power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but in this case, on the negative side, you know, what we call din, or justice. The Ramban, for example, in his commentary on the Torah, regarding, you remember on Yom HaKippurim, they used to send something called the Sa'ir La'Azazel? Do you remember that? It was a he-goat that was sent to a place called Azazel, and the Ramban thinks that the Azazel represents this sar, this power who's the officer of evil, and the Ramban goes into a whole long discussion why we send him a carbon on Yom Kippur, the Holy of Holy Days. We're not allowed to send him a carbon to a shade or to a sayer, seir. And the Ramban has a whole thesis. I mean, that's not for now. In any event, I'm looking at the clock and I'm saying, oy vey, we got 15 minutes here, and I did set myself a goal. What I'd like to discuss with you now is the Gemara's answer. We've gone through this digression. We're absolutely convinced, as Yoshua was, that this fellow, this gaunt figure, this unidentified figure, was not a shade, thank God. He was rather a Sar Tzava Hashem. But now we want to know, what does that have to do with the discussion here in Masechet Megillah about comparing Avodah to Talmud Torah and defining and deciding which is greater than which? Oh, so now the Gemara comes back. Now the Gemara is going to focus on the words Ata Basi. Do you remember that I filled in some of the blanks for you in terms of the Parsha in Yoshua? And one of the blanks was that after Yoshua asks this Sar Tzva Hashem, Ha Lanu Ata Im Litzarenu, are you with us or against us? The Sar Tzva Hashem says, Ata Basi, now I have come. What does that mean, now I have come? Now and not yesterday? Oh. So the Gemara says the following. Omar Lo, what did this angel of God come to tell? What did he mean to tell Yoshua in this very cryptic code language? Emesh. Emesh means the evening before. Yesterday evening is called in Hebrew Emesh, even to this day in modern Hebrew. Emesh, yesterday in the afternoon. Bitaltem tomid shel bein harbayim. You did not bring the afternoon sacrifice. In other words, you were so involved in the siege against the enemy, in this case against the Yericho, the city of Yericho. So within that context of the Battle of Jericho, you neglected, that's a good word, you neglected to bring the Tamid Shel Bein Arbayim. That's strike number one. And furthermore, you coupled one, how shall I say, sin with another sin. Achshav, now, meaning tonight, because keep in mind that this Sar Tzva Hashem appeared to Yoshua at night. Bitaltem Talmud Torah. You should have been involved in the study of Torah, and you didn't do so. Okay, during the day, perhaps you were so preoccupied with the siege and with the battle that you didn't have the opportunity to study Torah, but now you're at night, and there's no battle at night, so you're encamped. Now you should have been involved in the study of Torah. Meaning, this Sar Tzva Hashem had a very harsh message, a double message in effect, to Yoshua, to bring to the people of Israel. You know, where's your love for Torah? You know, 40 years in the desert, now you're entering into Eretz Yisrael, you should really take every opportune moment to study Torah. Omar Lo, so Yoshua turns back to the Malach, and he asks him the following question, Al Eza Mehem Basa, meaning, are you coming to warn us, to threaten us that God is bringing about a punishment? And if so, for which of the two violations? He's implying the following question, I think. You didn't come yesterday. Now you can, well, okay, that's not fair. You didn't come yesterday. I mean, you didn't come at the beginning of the evening, you know, right after dusk, after sunset. Why did you wait till now? Omar Lo, so the Malach responds, Ata Basi, now I came, meaning I came on the Avera that you're violating now, this evening, this night. And that is what? That you're not involved in Torah study. Meaning, the Malach is implying, had it been that you neglected to bring the Karvan Tamid, Shel Bein Arbayim, but you studied Torah at night, maybe I would have looked the other way. But you coupled evil with evil, and the second evil, the second sin, is even worse than the first. Wow, how could you do such a thing and fritter away your time without dedicating it to the study of Torah? Miyad. Immediately, when Yoshua hears these words, from the Malach and realizes that it's time to do tshuva, he accepts upon himself that he shouldn't repeat this sin in the future. And indeed, when he goes out to the next battle, anybody know what the next battle was after Jericho? I'm just testing your knowledge of Tanakh. Ai, excellent. The battle of Ai. And there in the battle of Ai, Vayelchu el Mara, there too they went to some ambush against the city of Ai. And the Tanakh testifies, Vayolen Yoshua Balaila Hahu Bitoch Ha'emek. And Yoshua, on that night, rested Bitoch Ha'emek in the, literally, valley. The Omar Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan says that what does this indicate? What is this coming to teach us, this pasuk? Melamed Shelon, that Yoshua, well, rested literally, together with all of Klal Yisrael, Biomka Shel Halacha. The word Emek, which literally means a valley, symbolically means Omek, the depth, because a valley is deep below surface level. But in this case, the meaning of this pasuk symbolically is the depth of intellectual study of halacha. And the commentaries point out here that why is Rabbi Yochanan so convinced that you can't take this pasuk literally? And the answer is because later on in this parsha, a few psukim later, right, this pasuk is, let me just check this out. This pasuk is pasuk tes, the ninth pasuk in this chapter, the eighth chapter of Yeshua. In pasuk Yud Gimel it says, Vayelech Yeshua Balailahu Betoch Ha'emek. So there's another pasuk that says he was Betoch Ha'emek. So the Torah must be sending us some message. And Betoch Ha'emek sounds like he was inside the Emek. Whereas here in this pasuk it says Vayon Balailahu Betoch Ha'am. In other words, somehow he took the nation with him into this Emek. And what is this Emek? It's the Omka Shel Halacha, the deep study of Halacha. So what do we see over here? Would the Malach have castigated the people of Israel so severely, so harshly, had it only been for the Avera, the violation that they didn't bring the Karban Tamid? Absolutely not. Ata Basi, says the Malach, the reason I'm coming is now, because of this Avera. So which Avera then is more severe? The Avera of Bittul Torah, or the Avera of Bittul Havoda, Bittul HaKarban? Anybody?
It seems that Bittul Torah is more significant.
It's more significant, correct. And this is a question on Beis Rebbe. Because as you remember, Beis Rebbe had a Kalvah Chomer which assumed that Talmud Torah is not as great as Avoda. Avoda is greater than Talmud Torah. Here we see that with regard to Bittul Talmud Torah, the response of Hashem through this message that was brought in by the Sartzva Hashem was that much more severe of a violation than the violation of Avoda. And here I'd like to share with you an insight of the Netziv Mivalozhin. You may know that Valozhin was a great yeshiva back, I'd say about 100 and maybe 20 years ago, but over the course of time before that, in Lithuania, and the Rosh Yeshiva for a long period of time was the Netziv. The Netziv says the following. How do we know, where do we see in the Psukim any indication that there was a bittul of the Tamid, that they didn't bring the Tamid, and there was a bittul of Talmud Torah? Where is that indicated in the Psukim? So he says the following. Very interesting insight. He says that during the 40-year period preceding this, in the Midbar, in the desert, then from the time of the Chet HaEgel and on, there was a question as to how God would lead the people, would direct the people? Would it be through an intermediary of a malach, or would it be directly God's hand in protecting the people and providing them with support? For example, the man that fell from Shemayim, in protecting them from all sorts of enemies and dangers. So if you look at the Gemara in Ksuvis, the Gemara assumes, this is the Netziv's Chiddush, that Parnasa, which means to sustain the people of Israel, that was a result, that was a reward for Karbonos. You remember that in the Mishkan they brought Karbonos. The protection of the Jewish people against their enemies, based this on a Chazal in the Medrash, is a result of the merit of Talmud Torah. So keep this in mind, that Parnasa came to Klal Yisrael Bizchus HaKarbonos. And Haganah, and protection against the enemies, came to Klal Yisrael, was provided by God, Bizchus, in merit of Talmud Torah. Now, after the Chet HaEgel, God wanted to punish the Jewish people and remove His closeness, His intimate relationship. He wanted to take a few steps back and maintain a distance with Klal Yisrael, so that His Hashgacha would be through some sort of intermediary. Because up until the Chet HaEgel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Mashgiach on Klal Yisrael in a direct way, not through a Malach, but after the Chet HaEgel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Hinei Malachi Yelech Lefanecha. Rashi says, Malachi, my Malach, Velo Ani, I will not go forward to accompany and protect the Jewish people directly, but rather indirectly. I will send a Malach instead, an intermediary. And Moshe Rabbeinu stood up and he prayed for a long time, and he was successful in repealing this decree, this decree against the Jewish people, this very harsh decree. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to Moshe's prayers in Shmos, Perek Lamed Beis, and he says, Panai Yelechu Vanichosi Lecha, I will go directly with you, and I will protect you, I will not send a Malach. And this situation continued throughout the period in the desert, until they came to Jericho. At the Battle of Jericho, now there was a critical moment. Because when Yoshua saw this Malach, this Sar Tzva Hashem, he began to think, well, what's going on? Is he coming to protect the Jewish people? Or have we sinned and gone down in our level, and therefore God doesn't want to direct us and protect us directly, but rather He's sending an intermediary? And Yoshua began to think, well, why is it that God now is punishing us and sending this Malach rather than having a direct relationship with us? What sin did we violate? Was it the sin of Bittul Torah? And therefore He is protecting us against our enemies through this Malach, because as we said before, it's the mitzvah of Torah study that has the power to protect us against our enemies. Or is He coming to help us sustain ourselves, Parnasa, which as we said before, is usually in the merit of bringing Karbonos. In other words, what's the deficiency here? If we're lacking in Karbonos, then this Malach is coming to be the intermediary to bring us Parnasa. If on the other hand we were lacking, we were deficient in Torah study, then no doubt this Malach is coming to protect us against our enemies. And he wasn't sure about it. Yoshua was in doubt. And these two possibilities existed. So therefore, he turns to the Malach, and he says to him, Halanu ata imutzarenu. Lanu means for us, to bring us a parnasa, and mizonos. Litzarenu means our enemies. Are you coming to protect us by bestowing upon us parnasa, or are you coming to protect us against our enemies? And that would clarify for Yeshua which sin the Jewish people were guilty of. And lo and behold, the Malach responds, Ani Sar Tzva Hashem, I'm coming with a sword to protect you as the Sar Tzva. Sar Tzva means the military leader of God and the divine battalion to protect you against your enemies. If so, the answer to Yeshua's question was that Klal Yisrael were deficient in the midst of Talmud Torah study, and therefore they no longer had God's direct protection against their enemies. And the question was, would they succeed in this battle, in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, first in the battle of Yericho? And the answer is that when Yeshua asks the Malach, why did you come? Is it because we mevatel the karbanos, or is it because we mevatel the Torah, the Torah study? And the answer is ata basi. Ata means now, for the avera that you're doing now on this very night, bittul Torah. And therefore, I'm coming to protect you against your enemies. Because if you don't have Torah to protect yourself against the enemies, then I have to come and protect you against the enemies. But that's conditional on the fact that you do tshuva, and therefore immediately Yeshua got together the people of Israel to study Torah publicly as a community and do tshuva for the chait of bittul Torah, and that would guarantee God's protection against the enemies and the success in the battle of Yericho. Okay, we'll stop here, even though we're hanging in the middle of the sugya, and we'll continue b'li neder.